Welcome to Pod Save America. I'm John Favreau.
I'm John Lovett.
I'm Tommy Vitor.
On today's show, we're going to talk about Mike Johnson's disappearing House majority that also might get rid of him, Bibi Netanyahu's beef with Joe Biden over the UN ceasefire resolution, the internal NBC revolt over the network's decision to hire former RNC chair Ronna McDaniel, and later, Georgia Senator Raphael Warnock stops by the studio to talk to Lovett about 2024 Gaza, TikTok, and more. But first, jury selection for the first ever criminal trial of a former president and current nominee will begin on April 15th. In this case, Trump is charged with falsifying business records to cover up a hush money payment to Stormy Daniels, the porn star he had an affair with.
If you're a Pod Save America listener in line at voir dire,
stay
in line.
Don't wear your shirt.
Don't wear your shirt.
Don't wear the shirt. So Trump's lawyers tried to use the release of new documents from federal prosecutors as an excuse to delay the trial, but Judge Juan Merchan argued that the defense has had plenty of time. So we're getting at least one Trump trial before the election. At least one.
At least one.
At least one. Trump got some slightly better news from a New York appeals court on Monday, which lowered the amount of the bond he needs to post for his civil fraud verdict from $454 million to $175 million within the next 10 days. He seems to think he'll be able to come up with that amount. Here he is at a press conference after the hearing.
Well, as they say, I have a lot of cash. You know I do because you looked at my statements. I mean, you've been examining my statements for a long time. And I have much more than that in cash. But I would also like to be able to use some of my cash to get elected. They don't want me to use my cash to get elected. They don't want that. They don't want me taking cash out to use it for the campaign. I didn't even include, like, brand value. And the brand value is, I became president because of the brand, let's say. But the brand value is, it's one of the most valuable brand values. So I think it's, I wouldn't swap it for any other brand in the world, Trump.
Got a lot of cash, plus all that Nazi gold in Ivana's coffin.
Be very. I just love at the end where you go, Trump.
Trump.
I wouldn't trade that brand for any other brand in the world. Trump.
Very funny if he just walked in the courtroom and was like, an IOU, 20% of my brand.
Yeah.
Leverage that.
Can't buy bread with brand.
So, huge bummer that we won't get to see Tish James seize Trump Tower.
It sucks.
We don't get anything.
We don't get anything.
No fun.
I wanted that building.
Yep.
That was going to be our building.
Now,
Trump, Tish James, who doesn't have a political bone in her body, was going to get that building for us.
Trump was fundraising off the fact that she was going to take the building.
Ugh.
And now today he's fundraising off the fact that he just says there's a big fundraising email that just says Trump Tower still mine.
That sucks.
So, like, what is that fundraising
that
for?
Sucks.
You already got the tower back and you seemingly have plenty of cash. But we will get to see Trump spend most of his spring in a Manhattan courtroom. What's your take on the political implications of Monday's legal news?
I mean, you heard it in the clip there. He keeps talking about putting his own money into the campaign. I couldn't tell if he was trying to suggest that he's going to put some of his personal funds behind his election effort, which I doubt he will actually do given history, or if he just now talks about campaign donations like it's his own personal cash.
I took it to mean the first part, which is, I mean, he hasn't done that since 2016, but he did do that in 2016, and then obviously he did it in 2020. And I wonder if he's considering it.
Here's what I took it to mean. I took it to mean he knows he's about to write a massive check, and he's going to say, I need your donations because these political hacks are taking my money, not to hurt me for anything I did wrong or to punish me, but to stop me from being able to support my campaign. Will you step in to make up for what these Jew prosecutors have done to me? It's always a little bit in there.
Yeah, okay.
The other thing I thought was, you sort of referenced it. I mean, it's got to be the most distracting way to possibly run a presidential campaign. You gotta remember all these judges' names.
Yeah,
you gotta read all these
it.
Documents. You gotta spend months and months in court. You gotta wage your little PR wars against Tish James and Goron.
I mean, we should get into the schedule here. So if it starts April 15th, that's jury selection. That'll take about 2 weeks. And then the case will probably last, estimates range now from like late May into June. So he has to appear in court from 9:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday. Gets Wednesday off, though, you know, you're not traveling too far if you have to get back there for Thursday.
Right.
So that's a lot of the campaign. And that's just the first trial. Now, I realize he'll, like, use it to raise money and he'll do his little press conference outside the courtroom. But I don't know. Does that wear well?
It's not the primary, right? I mean, right. That's when we had the big rally around Trump effect within the Republican Party. I don't know that you can assume that will happen again, at least not with swing voters.
I also continue to think that the kind of prospect of Trump being on trial will feel very different than Trump actually being on trial, where there's images and sounds and all the machinations that go along with the people's imaginations and knowledge of like how the criminal justice system works, and that will make him look very bad to normal people who will just be tuning into the campaign.
Trump, like the rest of us, is just adjusting to a post-pandemic hybrid work schedule.
That's true.
Oh, that's right. That's
true. 3 days in, a couple days out. Right. It's going to limit his.
I wonder if he's going to say that to the judge. Be like, can I do some remote court?
Why not? Give it a whirl.
It's going to be a hard case to prove. Proving falsified business records actually is the easy part for Alvin Bragg, though that's just a misdemeanor in New York unless you falsify business records to cover up another crime. And in this case, that other crime is not reporting his hush money payment to the Federal Election Commission, which would be a federal crime, not a state crime, if it's judged a crime at all, and it's a crime that DOJ declined to charge him with, right? So there's a lot of moving pieces here. Mm-hmm. Like, I think he should be able to prove the falsified business records fairly easily, but it's sort of taking the next leap to covering up the other crime, which clearly it was. There's some complications there.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm sure the open-minded Manhattan jury will approach this and try to be as fair as they possibly can to Donald Trump.
It is interesting. We get nothing.
The one thing that's kind of cool is all the juries are coming from D.C. and Manhattan. Like that's like we get one perk.
Well, I know. And meanwhile, Aileen Cannon down in Florida is like, how can I spike this thing humanly possible?
Right.
So Trump also said at the end of that sort of press avail after courtroom today that he's going to pay cash for the bond. That's what he says. He's also a little richer on paper this week, thanks to his shitty Twitter knockoff, Truth Social. The company lost $49 million last year, but it just started trading on the NASDAQ Monday under the stock ticker DJT, with Trump's stake currently worth about $3 billion, though he's not allowed to sell his shares for 6 months. Is this real? Is this a Ponzi scheme? And how many shares have you guys bought?
I reject the characterization of this as a Ponzi scheme, because in a Ponzi scheme, you have to pay out some money to your early investors with funds from the later ones. And I don't see that happening.
Right, right. A Ponzi scheme involves like there's a couple rungs of the pyramid that do okay. You can't just have the top. That's just stealing from people. I just keep thinking about that scene from The Sopranos where the two henchmen are like beating the shit out of some stockbroker saying, we're pushing Wabistics. That's what I picture. Just some boiler room somewhere just being like, we're pushing Trump stocks today. It's Trump stocks.
Yeah. I mean, this is like just a way to siphon cash from Trump fans, right? I think, or anyone who wants to really buy influence. It's like, if you hate Trump, if you hate big tech, if you hate the elites, buy some shares of DJT. It's a meme stock. It's a cult initiation fee. It's a securitized Trump stake. It's an oligarch. I mean, you know, it's all in one. It's fun.
But like this, the stock price here is basically just rising or falling based on Trump's popularity, betting on Donald Trump. It's like a bunch of his supporters sort of did this, and then some other people who just want to do like a pump and dump kind of thing here.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
like that's what this is.
I mean, some people will make money, some people will lose money. My question is like, can Trump get money out of this before it collapses, if it collapses? Like, can he start selling bits of it just to get some of the money out before the reality of the company not making any money?
Well, yeah, and
by
the way,
face to face with the stock price.
I should have said it's a 6 month lockup till he can sell his shares, but the board can vote to change that. And the board is made up of Don Jr. and Linda McMahon and all of his
Linda McMahon.
All of his goons are on the board. So, you know.
Right. Truth Social is not trading on a multiple on its revenues. That is that is absolutely true.
Because the revenue was $3 million last year.
Yeah, this is not Berkshire Hathaway. This is 5 billion active users on Truth Social selling scammy ads to people for like toenail fungus. What I liked, I went a little trip down memory lane. The initial pitch for Truth Media and Technology Group, which is the company that's merging with the other company, the SPAC, to form DJT, was Truth Social. And then they had a Netflix-like streaming service, a Trump streaming service. And then they had some longer-term play to create competitors to Google, Amazon, and Stripe. So I guess e-commerce search and payments.
So close.
So if you're hoping to make a return, I would not hold your breath until those businesses come to fruition.
Did you guys see, we also learned that the biggest institutional shareholder of the shell company that merged with Truth Social's parent company is Jeff Yass. You might have heard that name recently because he's also major investor in TikTok. He owns a bunch of ByteDance, the parent company for TikTok. And he also happens to be a major donor to Club for Growth. Club for Growth is paying Kellyanne Conway to lobby against the TikTok ban. And lo and behold, Donald Trump flip-flopped on the TikTok ban. But it is all just a coincidence.
It's just a coincidence.
Nothing is connected here.
It's his ability to sort of dance between the raindrops for years and years and years. That just the man doesn't get wet. Maybe he'll finally get wet.
Yeah, it's 91 raindrops.
Yeah. Let's get this guy wet. What the fuck?
Just like, let's get this guy wet.
Let's get this guy.
I don't want to yell clip that, but I don't want to explain
it. I don't either. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Okay. You know what I'm talking about.
Okay. Yeah, no, I sure.
True Social, he's got $3 billion in his valuation.
Yeah, well, he's got a bunch of idiots who are just like, sure. I mean, you said like buy influence. I don't even know if they're buying influence. They're just like, Donald Trump's fucking Jesus Christ.
No, it's both. I think mostly it's Trump fans who like want to own a share of DJT to stick it to all the elites who don't like him. But then if you want to siphon money to Trump, this is a very efficient way to do it. You buy a ton of shares of his little company now. I mean, you could previously, if you were a Saudi delegation, you just stayed at the Trump hotel for a month longer than you needed to, and you just let the room sit vacant.
But did a deal with Jared.
Yeah, this is a new, more efficient way, potentially.
Unreal. One more fun Trump thing. Did you guys see that he congratulated himself on Truth Social, the multi-billion dollar company, for winning 2 trophies at his own golf club? Said, it's my great honor to be at my golf club to receive the club championship trophy and the senior club championship trophy. I won both.
If you believe Trump is a scratch golfer, I've got a stock on the NASDAQ to sell you.
Are you guys surprised that he would take credit for winning a senior open?
I thought about that. Yeah, it's very
old.
I think that, yeah. I'm also just sort of like, so you're at your own golf club and you get in the tournament for all your customers.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, I'm going to wipe the floor with these people.
Then you win, and then you congratulate yourself about winning at your golf club, at your own golf. Like, what?
Maybe not, yeah.
Listen, you guys are making me realize this is very Kim Jong-il. He shot a 38 under par, including 11 holes in one, the first time he ever played. So setting him aside, I do think Trump has won something like 20 club championships, but only at clubs he owns.
Yeah.
Again.
But in some cases, he didn't actually play in the tournament. Like one time he ran into a dude who had just won the tournament. He challenged him to like a 9-hole match, and then he beat him. And then he declared himself the co-champion.
Like each side could send their best champion to fight in the middle instead of having a big battle.
I mean, he's facing multiple criminal charges for cheating in an election. So no, I can't imagine him.
There's that old joke about the golfer. You're golfing with somebody and they lose their ball in the woods and they're looking. And they can't find it, and you go over to hit your golf ball, and then all of a sudden you hear from the woods, I found it, and he hits his ball, gets it right next to the tee, and the question you face is, do you call the man a cheater, or do you keep his ball in your pocket?
Rick Riley from Sports Illustrated.
It's a classic.
Wrote a whole book about Trump cheating at golf. It's a funny thing because it's very polarizing. I think his fans find it hilarious. Like, they know he's lying. This is nonsense, right? But they find it hilarious. Some haters despise him. I mostly just have always found it confusing that people like this about him. Like, cheating at sports is annoying. Constantly whining and being a victim is annoying. How does this not wear worse over time?
Yeah, I think it's a good point. I don't know if it does. I mean, Joe Biden, our boy Joe Biden, had a really funny tweet.
Great tweet.
He quote
great
tweeted
tweet.
The truth, and he just said, congratulations, Donald, quite the accomplishment. That's the tone. That's mm-hmm. the humor. I love it. More of it.
I enjoyed it too.
Do it. It's great.
Yeah, no, but I know. But Tommy, I know you mean, because it's like, I feel like, but wait, weren't we all taught growing up that like that's not strength, that that's weakness, right? Like it's whiny, it's an embarrassing way to behave, that like being that much of a braggart is not like cool or how a real kind of person, right, who really has faith in themselves would behave.
Remember he was gonna award himself the Congressional Medal of Freedom when he was president?
Yeah.
No, instead he just gave it to Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah.
Right.
R.I.P. All right, moving on. The House of Representatives is taking a well-earned two-week recess that Republicans may not want to come back from. Axios says they're leaving with, quote, their base enraged, their majority in tatters, and their speaker facing the prospect of a humiliating ouster at the hands of his own MAGA allies. I hate to see it. This is mostly because Mike Johnson worked with Democrats to avoid a government shutdown by passing a bill with the same spending levels that cost Kevin McCarthy his job 10 months ago when he made a deal with Joe Biden about the budget. Turns out that same deal is what we just got over the weekend. This led Marjorie Taylor Greene to introduce a motion to vacate, though that doesn't appear to be going anywhere just yet. Then Representative Mike Gallagher announced that he'll be vacating his seat next month, which will leave Republicans with a one-seat majority. Also, James Comer said they won't be impeaching Joe Biden after all. Kooks aren't too happy about any of this. Here's Stop the Steal enthusiast Andy Biggs answering some questions on Newsmax.
Let's just, I mean, if you want to talk performance of Speaker Johnson, I'm as dismayed and disappointed as anybody.
In the House, Congressman, you think things are good for the Republican Party?
I think that we get along better than most people would think.
You understand why I'm asking, right? Kevin McCarthy abandoned you, Ken Buck abandoned you, and Mike Gallagher just announced on Friday that he's going to resign on April the 13th. You got a one-vote majority. What's going on in the House?
Well, I don't know why Kevin left, and I'm not sure I know why Ken or Mike's leaving and Ken left.
Well, when you put it that way.
Mike Johnson, welcome to the resistance.
Tough.
what you had read, just sort of walking through what Johnson is facing, you could have just, until you referenced McCarthy, you could have just replaced the word Johnson with McCarthy.
I thought about that.
The exact same situation, exact same politics, same bills, still the Ukraine funding. It's exact same. We've been in the same place for 10 months.
10 years.
No one is happy with Republicans controlling the House, not even House Republicans. I mean, it's just like they can't keep a speaker. They can't agree on anything as a caucus, let alone a House. People want another 2 years of this. They just keep replacing speaker after speaker with more extreme versions who still aren't extreme enough for like the lunatic fringe of their party. Investigations based on nothing that don't go anywhere. It's
impeachment's going great.
Impeachment's done.
Well done, guys.
It's going to be the least productive Congress in history by a lot. Basically, all they've done is barely kept the government open, renamed a few post offices.
Nice.
They got all these younger members retiring, and not just retiring, but then like leaving early.
Quitting immediately.
They can't even wait till the end of their term.
I think because there's a real game theory problem here, because once the majority got this low, you have to leave quick, because if you want to leave and take a job before your term is up, and if you wait too long, suddenly leaving to get your whatever high-paid consulting job or something turns the House over to the Democrats, right?
Yeah, you don't want
to
be that last vote.
Gallagher's the last person who can leave without causing them to go to what? An even split fucking clusterfuck? You know there's seven other people that are like, ah, fuck.
Yeah, they all want to be lobbyists.
They want to make the money.
Ken Buck's out. He already left, and he signed on to the Democrats' Ukraine discharge petition right before he walked out the door. So these people aren't just leaving. They're like leaving with like a couple fuck yous to leadership.
Yeah.
Like they didn't even get, neither of them, Gallagher or Buck, neither of them gave Johnson a heads up that they were leaving.
Or no. A gift. Or a
or
note.
Gift.
Or nothing.
Even, by the way, George Santos announced he's leaving the Republican Party. He's running as an independent.
I would say the party left him, John.
So MTG, she basically said this is like a warning shot. It's like a resolution to introduce the motion to vacate, but she hasn't triggered it yet. I don't know. Who cares? But anyway, the question is, some Democrats have said, well, if she files this, we might keep Mike Johnson. We might vote to keep him. Do you guys see any good reasons for House Democrats to save Mike Johnson from being McCarthy'd?
I mean, the argument for it is that America is our accountability partner.
Mm, nice.
And that we need a speaker and a Congress in place to do serious things, because we're serious, responsible people, and we fund the government.
We're
and
watching
we
too
pass
much porn.
Bills and yeah, that too.
Yeah.
That's the argument for it. I don't know that I believe that.
So if you go back and look at what this conversation, which we've had before around McCarthy, looked like, Democrats were eager for McCarthy to keep his job, to get funding for Ukraine, award more federal projects in Democratic districts, And some went so far as to demand that right-wing Republicans be removed from the Rules Committee. Some wanted a promise that GOP campaign committees will not spend money to defeat politically vulnerable Democrats. I think that's probably a stretch.
That's a lot.
Up to including...
You start from... It's just a negotiating position.
demanding co-chairs for committees. We're now at the point where people just want the Ukraine aid. And fine, fair enough. But what's I feel like what's sort of twisted about all this is... Because the media treats Democrats as protagonists and Republicans as antagonists, and Republicans are just feral creatures wandering the earth, and Democrats are human beings with agency, it's incumbent upon us to figure out how to help them out of this jam. How about Mike Johnson? Throw together a couple options. What does Mike Johnson want for these Democratic votes? Never get a proposal from the Republicans for this. And I have another idea. I agree that we should have a functioning House of Representatives. If a few Republicans want to join and make Hakeem Jeffries the Speaker of the House, there's lots of interesting ways that they can be accommodated and made to feel welcome in the big, beautiful Democratic coalition that would surely be happy to have them. That's another option.
I don't know if any of them have enough money for the private security they'll need to hire if they take that vote. I think it's just you want the only thing they have left to do before the election, because of course you can't be legislating.
Nothing
this year
else is going to happen
because they all have senioritis because it's an election year. So they need to get Ukraine done.
Yep.
And the funding bill that they just passed goes to September 30th. So you don't want another shutdown in October right before the election. I would just say to Mike Johnson, like, put the Ukraine bill on the floor and let's agree on spending levels for
through December,
whatever. And fine, take the job. The House isn't doing anything anyway. Take the job.
I guess. But like, so we're just...
A little twerp.
Like
what else are we getting? Well, here's the alternative.
Something.
Well, the alternative is...
That's what we're getting. By the way, we're getting a version of that now.
The alternative is we lose Mike Johnson. Then we get, Andy Biggs or someone even crazier. Ukraine doesn't get done. There's no Ukraine funding. Well, and then we get another shutdown.
But maybe you also get another 3 weeks of disastrous infighting and votes and embarrassment and humiliation from the Republicans, and there's some political benefit from that.
You get content for us, and
that would
fun.
Be the
But I will say, like, what we would be... I think the reason people want to figure out a way to do this for Ukraine is because they genuinely believe that we have a moral obligation to fund Ukraine. But it is also a situation in which the reason Republicans would be desperate for Democrats to help them is because it would once again point out that they are a group of people that cannot govern the country and shouldn't be trusted with this responsibility.
Yeah.
And for the long-term health of the country, we want to win the House. So I think it's a little tough to just be like, yeah, well, that's the best we could get.
They're sitting at 11% approval ratings. So I feel like the country's got the message. I think that I get if you're a legislator, if you're a Democratic legislator and you believe that it's not just a moral obligation to fund Ukraine, but it is in our national security interest to fund Ukraine, then a couple days of Republicans looking like fucking clowns is not as worthwhile as getting this done and actually funding Ukraine.
Yeah, if you're a serious
get
person.
Get the Ukraine funding and then to fucking fuck them. Just like, let's get the Ukraine funding. Then we do our own motion to vacate.
I think...
Let's trick these bastards.
I'm sure there's a lot of very serious people in Congress, mostly in our party, who care deeply about this issue. There is an open question, though. If Johnson is saved with a bunch of Democratic votes, how does Trump react to that? He might have a meltdown. Be like, oh, little Mikey, he's weak. Can't do this with the Democrats. Well, you can see this going badly in a couple different ways.
Yeah, it'll be... Trump has different ways of sort of breaking off relationships. There's the like, I'm gonna blast you on Truth Social, right?
I'm gonna bury you at my golf course.
I'm gonna bury you at my golf course. That one. This one's just gonna be like, he's gonna forget that he ever knew Mike Johnson, kind of thing. That guy, who
never
was that
met
guy?
Him.
It was like a quick 5 month thing.
Dennis and the Menace we'll never from hear the from stage at the speech.
He was sort of weird. What was with that Covenant Eyes thing? Yeah. That was weird. That's what you'll be hearing Trump say.
I like that.
The country feels like it's falling apart right before our eyes, and the people inside it are being silenced.
So we're going to East 26th Street and Nicolet Avenue, which is where Alex Pretty was executed by ICE and Border Patrol.
That is not a headline. That is a human life, and it is all happening right now.
Do you worry about your own safety being involved in all this?
Yes, but it doesn't really feel like there's another option, you know?
And of course they use a 5-year-old child as bait. And of course they're doing all these horrible, bad things because they don't know what they're doing. They've been told that they're going to get rid of the worst, then they have absolute immunity. And they've been told that nothing they do will they ever be held accountable for.
On my show, Runaway Country, we go where the headlines hit home, from communities under threat to the people fighting to be heard. New episodes of Runaway Country drop every Thursday. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or watch on YouTube. The country feels like it's falling apart right before our eyes, and the people inside it are being silenced.
So we're going to East 26th Street and Nicolette Avenue, which is where Alex Preti was executed by ICE and Border Patrol.
That is not a headline. That is a human life. And it is all happening right now.
Do you worry about your own safety being involved in all this?
Yes, but it doesn't really feel like there's another option, you know?
And of course they use a five-year-old child as bait. And of course they're doing all these horrible, bad things because they don't know what they're doing. They've been told that they're going to get rid of the worst, then they have absolute immunity. And they've been told that nothing they do will they ever be held accountable for.
On my show, Runaway Country, we go where the headlines hit home, from communities under threat to the people fighting to be heard. New episodes of Runaway Country drop every Thursday. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or watch on YouTube.
So there were some big developments with Israel's war in Gaza on Monday. The UN Security Council was able to pass a resolution calling for a ceasefire after the U.S. abstained for the first time. This allegedly pissed off Bibi Netanyahu, who then canceled a planned visit by his senior advisors to the White House. Though the Biden administration said the abstention isn't a change in policy and reportedly told Israel in advance that they don't see the resolution as binding. Tommy, what did you make of all this? And has there been any movement in Washington on the effort to condition U.S. military aid to Israel, or even the other diplomatic efforts that the U.S. and Israel have been engaged in with Hamas?
So this resolution basically just reflects the longstanding Biden policy that they've been working towards for a while, which gets is a ceasefire and a release to the hostages. It calls for both. They abstained rather than vote for the resolution because some issues with the wording and also because it didn't condemn Hamas for the October 7th attack. So, I mean, I think some others, it's interesting that the administration says it's not legally binding. I think others would argue it is, but in practice, there's no enforcement mechanism without another vote by the Security Council for like to sanction Israel, for example, and the U.S. could veto that. All that said, it's a pretty big break from the norm, where the U.S. has vetoed a lot of U.N. resolutions over the years that criticize Israel, including several similar resolutions about Gaza that called for a ceasefire without demanding the release of hostages or condemning Hamas. More broadly, though, like this is another step in what seems like a pretty big divide between the U.S. and Israel. I think that Netanyahu seems to want this fight, and I think he's probably setting up an effort to just start running against Biden, but we'll see. The question of suspending aid is happening on a different track. In February, the Biden team put out this memorandum saying that any country that gets U.S. weapons has to use them in accordance with U.S. and international law. So the countries that receive these weapons, I think there's six of them, including Israel, submitted assurances in some written form last week. They're now being reviewed, and we will hear at some point what that review says, and it could result in the Biden administration deciding to withhold additional arms transfers. So there are 17 Democrats in the U.S. Senate who are saying these assurances are bogus. Do not give them more weapons, including like Durbin and Ben Hollen, like some centrist Dems. Human rights groups are saying these assurances are not true. They're violating international law. The Israeli military is in Gaza. And so we shall see.
And this is just a determination the Biden administration can make itself, and Congress doesn't necessarily have a role here.
Yeah, I think there's a determination that'll be made by the State Department and the Defense Department in something like 45 days from receiving these assurances, and then I think Biden makes a call.
Because I noticed that, so Bernie Sanders released a statement because there was $4 billion in military aid for Israel as part of the spending agreement, though I would imagine that's authorized by Congress or appropriated by Congress, and then the administration, if it decides to make this determination, it could probably just not send that.
Yeah, I mean, I think they could probably just find ways to slow down or cut off future weapons transfers. But yeah, I mean, that the big spending bill not only included $3.8 billion in military support for Israel, but it banned funding for the UN Relief and Works Agency, or UNRWA, which is the biggest employer in Gaza. They employ about 13,000 people in Gaza and provide relief. So some pretty big steps were taken in that bill.
Finally, fun times at NBC News right now. After the network's executives decided to hire former RNC chair and election denier Ronna McDaniel as a contributor for a reported $300,000 a year, journalists who work at NBC revolted, including an on-air rebuke from the network's chief political analyst, Chuck Todd. Chuck's Meet the Press successor, Kristen Welker, had just interviewed McDaniel, though Welker didn't know when she booked her that NBC had already hired her.
That's awkward.
Here's a clip of that interview and then what Chuck said to Welker afterwards.
Do you disagree with Trump saying he's going to free those who've been charged?
I do not think people who committed violent acts on January 6th should be freed.
So you disagree with that? He's been saying that for months. Ronna, why not speak out earlier? Why just speak out about that now?
When you're the RNC chair, you kind of take one for the whole team, right? Now I get to be a little bit more myself, right? This is what I believe.
Look, let me deal with the elephant in the room.
Yeah.
I think our bosses owe you an apology for putting you in this situation, because I don't know what to believe. She is now a paid contributor by NBC News. So I have no idea whether any answer she gave to you was because she didn't want to mess up her contract. Mm. She wants us to believe that she was speaking for the RNC when the RNC was paying for it. And look, there's a reason why there's a lot of journalists at NBC News uncomfortable with this, because many of our professional dealings with the RNC over the last 6 years have been met with gaslighting. When NBC made the decision to give her NBC News' credibility, you got to ask yourself, what does she bring NBC News? And when we make deals like this, and I've been at this company a long time, you're doing it for access.
Good Chuck. For Chuck.
Way to go, Chuck.
Kristen Welker did a great job
yes.
in the interview, too.
I know.
It was a 20-minute grilling.
I know. I watched it to prep for this because I hadn't actually seen the whole thing
either.
On Sunday. And I was like, wow, she did a really great job.
That was
a
really good job.
What did you guys think of the uproar? And what do you think compelled NBC to hire her in the first place?
So I think it's at one point in that interview with Welker, she says Biden won fair and square, right? Mm-hmm. So she's finally saying Biden won fair and square. But all along, she was just saying it. She was doing what she had to do as RNC chair.
Well, Welker played a clip of her talking to Chris Wallace just last year where she said, quote, I don't think Biden won it fair. I don't. I'm not going to say that.
Yeah. It's interesting how much this has sort of shifted over the last 6-8 years, which is, I actually think, reflects something good, which is I think a lot of journalists, especially at like big mainstream outlets that were sort of kind of much more comfortable in being in the role of kind of referee and sort of viewing it as a match between two sides that they were sort of in the middle of, I think have kind of learned that that their role changes when the losing team tries to burn the stadium to the ground. And I also think that has been helped by the fact that they have been dealt with personal attacks for years.
Oh, yeah.
They have seen the dark side of this. They have seen the anti-democratic, authoritarian viciousness come for them personally, affect them personally, affect their colleagues, affect the way they cover the news. And it seems as though that attitude, that understanding that, yes, a lot of the times we are between two sides, but then there are times where we as journalists are on the side of democracy versus the people on the outside of it, I think has been internalized by people who are covering the news much more than the people who are further away from it.
Yeah.
I just found it to be a baffling decision. I mean, she just got tossed out of Trump world. She does not seem well dialed into like normie Republican world. I'm sure the Nikki Haley team probably does not like Ronna very much. I don't know that she's dialed into the Hill. So per Chuck's point, you pay contributors to get access. I'm not sure what access she gets you. There's obviously also the far more serious credibility problem. And I think for people like Chuck, it wasn't just that they were lying to him. They were brutally attacking him like week after week after week in most personal terms. And so I guess the reason you pay her as a contributor is to have a consistent pro-Trump voice on through the election and to keep her from going to competitors. But like, who's spun up to watch the Ronna exclusive, at least after this one?
It does illustrate the larger problem with having... Oh, we just need a pro-Trump voice, because pro-Trump voices, again, they tell you that the election was stolen.
Yeah, up is
and
down.
You just have to draw a line somewhere. Like look, if NBC wants to waste its money on someone who's not even a skilled propagandist, like it's their right to make a dumb business decision. And I do think like political diversity on a network news is important, and have people hash it out, argue it out, and stuff like that. But you just have to draw a line somewhere, and the line has to be burning the stadium down. Like you said, the line has to be like, if you've been telling lies about an attempted coup, we're going to draw the line there. And if that's even if that represents the views of millions of Americans, that doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be on fucking network news, and you have to fact check the person every time they're on.
Well,
it's just a hard thing to do.
Yeah, it does sound like, just from some of the kind of coverage, that Ronna Romney McDaniel got sorted Romney kind of interpersonally, right? Like that she's from that tradition, so she's one of the normal Republicans that we're still allowed to have on. And sure, she kind of had to defend Trump, but once she's on our air, she'll be a much more reasonable person. But people don't, it's a golf day. There's no mulligan on calling for the overthrow of the government.
4 more years? No, yeah, I take that back. Yeah, no, to your point, NBC reportedly got close with her because they were negotiating to host a debate with the RNC. So that's how she greased this deal. But you are insulting your audience by putting a known liar on TV all the time and paying that person. And also, I think like this is what everyone hates about Washington. It's this chummy nonsense, is that everyone knows that everyone's doing a kayfabe and it's a bit, and we know she's a liar, but now she's mopping up afterwards, and that's somehow okay.
And again, like, you know, Alyssa Farah Griffin, she was in Trump world. She was in the Trump White House till the very end. And when she left and she became a contributor, you know, I think I probably criticized it myself, right? Like we did. But she also sort of did a mea culpa, right? Like, this was wrong, and I've seen there was none of that from Ronna.
By the way,
NBC. I was just like, no. I was taking one for the team, and I was sort of lying when I was there, and now I'm here, and you kind of got to take one for the team. I mean,
defending a coup. There was a report, I think it was a Maggie Haberman story in the Times about Trump trying to get the primaries to be over early to kind of push Nikki Haley aside. And it was midway through the story, it mentions almost in passing that Trump called Ronna McDaniel and said, hey, can we not only cancel the debates, but can we cancel the elections altogether?
And she put out a statement.
And so the idea that like, oh, you know, she was just being a team player. She was complicit in this 4 years.
By the way, that doesn't mean like have her on Meet the Press. Kristen Welker's interview with her was fantastic.
Yeah.
Just if she's a paid contributor, that, and again, for NBC, that means every time she's on the air, you have to make sure she's not lying and you have to like fact check her. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
There's also just a lot of former Trump officials at this point that you could go to that are more compelling and have more credibility and are better dialed into this world.
Yeah, that is also true. It's a real head scratcher.
It's a real just.
I don't think she'll be on Maddow tonight. So what do you guys think?
MSNBC guest is going to burn her at the stake. It's going to be a live town hall.
Yeah. Yeah, like Nicole Wallace is nailing her demands to the door of 30 Rock.
Yeah, they're going to drown her like a witch.
Does Ronna float?
Guess we'll just leave it there, huh?
Yeah, it's okay. Great place to end. let's go to the interview with the
I was
going to
say, we're going to do a couple housekeeping items before we're going to give that to Senator Warnock to make sure we hook her right to him. We got a new episode of Inside 2024 out on Thursday. Cal Penn joins Dan and Alyssa to talk about their time in the White House together, and they're going to get into just how accurate political shows like Veep and The West Wing really are. To get access to this Friends of the Pod subscription series and others, head to crooked.com/friends now. Also, this week, the Supreme Court will hear oral arguments in a case that will decide the right to access the abortion pill. If you want to help support nationwide abortion freedom, you can pick up any item from Crooked's No Trespassing collection, and a portion of the proceeds will go to Vote Save America's Fuck Bans the Fight Back Fund, which currently supports abortion rights organizations across Arizona, Nevada, and Florida. When we come back, Lovett talks to Georgia Senator Raphael Warnock.
The country feels like it's falling apart right before our eyes, and the people inside it are being silenced.
So we're going to East 26th Street and Nicolet Avenue, which is where Alex Pretty was executed by ICE and Border Patrol.
That is not a headline. That is a human life. And it is all happening right now.
Do you worry about your own safety being involved in all this?
Yes, but it doesn't really feel like there's another option, you know?
And of course they use a five-year-old child as bait. And of course they're doing all these horrible, bad things because they don't know what they're doing. They've been told that they're going to get rid of the worst of the worst. Then they have absolute immunity. And they've been told that nothing they do will they ever be held accountable for.
On my show, Runaway Country, we go where the headlines hit home, from communities under threat to the people fighting to be heard. New episodes of Runaway Country drop every Thursday. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or watch on YouTube.
Don't you wish everything was more rewarding? With Rakuten, almost everything is. You can earn cash back on those new shoes you've been wanting. You can save on the next trip you book. You can cash in on groceries. Just join. Shop your favorite brands and save. Target, Instacart, Expedia, Macy's, Sephora, CVS. The list is long. Save online, in-store, and at over 22,000 restaurants. And when it's time to redeem those rewards, get your money exactly how you want it. Choose PayPal, check, Bilt points, or cash out with gift cards. So go ahead, take a trip, fill a cart, order dessert. Rakuten is a world of rewards. Join today for free. Go to Rakuten.com or get the app. That's Rakuten.
Joining us in studio, a man who's won elections in the critical state of Georgia four times in the last 4 years, five if you count the primary.
Five times, but who's counting?
United States Senator and pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church, Senator Reverend Raphael Warnock. Welcome back to the pod.
Great to be back.
It's good to see you. The last time I saw you, I was in Atlanta. Now you're in LA.
That's right.
Our turf.
I was on your turf the last time. I was on your show.
I guess that's true. how does it feel to finally not be running in an election in Georgia? Do you have... nightmares where you wake up and you're on the ballot and you forgot and you're in your underwear and your teacher's there?
Something like that.
You do, actually. You do wake up in the night thinking you've forgotten you're up for re-election.
Look, I ran 3 years straight. My name was on the ballot five times, if you count. The jungle primary, which nobody remembers, that when I entered the my first race, mm-hmm. I had 20 opponents.
20 opponents.
I think that's easy to forget now, Democrats and Republicans. And here we are. I am glad that I am not running this year, but I'm very committed to making sure that we maintain our majority in the Senate, hopefully expand it, flip the House, and send Joe Biden and Kamala Harris back to the White House.
Well, so one problem of you not being on the ballot is we don't have your coattails. All right, Senator, President Biden carried Georgia by under 12,000 votes, became the first Democrat to win the state in three decades. The latest polls have Trump up a couple points. What has to change for Biden to win Georgia in 2024?
Well, listen, in this business, you pay attention to the polls, but I think it's a strategic error to be obsessed with the polls. Mm-hmm. I call it the polar coaster.
Yeah, yeah.
And look, it's still relatively early in the election season. I think we'll see these polls go up and down. And here's what we know at the end of the day, it's going to be close.
Yeah.
And since it's going to be close, we've got to turn our people out. We've got to help people to understand what's at stake. And I do think that as we get closer to the election and people recognize that at the end of the day, this is a binary choice, nothing else, binary choice. And the contrast could not be more stark. The consequences and the stakes, in my view, could not be higher. And I think that as we make that case, both about what the president has done, and it's impressive, and about the scary alternative, I believe the people of Georgia are going to do for Joe Biden what they did for me and send him back to the White House.
You see these polls, and people often believe Joe Biden is ineffective, in part because of age, but they also have no idea how much has gotten done. Do you find that when you're out there campaigning? How do we get the word out about some of the achievements that make Joe Biden worthy of a second term?
Well, you know, Democrats aren't always that good at talking about what we've gotten done. I think we stay really, really focused on getting things done. But here are the facts. You know, I think about this as a senator. I think about this as we consider our base. Black unemployment is at a record low. We've seen a 60% increase in black wealth since before the pandemic. We've seen a 30-year high in the opening up of black businesses. We've invested some $7 billion in historically black colleges and universities. They say, you know, in some of the neighborhoods that I move around in Atlanta, Joe Biden's got receipts. And I think the job is ours to continue to make that case. One of the things that I've been doing is that as I go and talk to rooms all across our state, lately I've been asking people, if you or somebody you know has had their student debt canceled or relieved. And believe it or not, in all the rooms I've been going to, hands go up. And in some places, as much as 60, 70% of the room. And we've done $144 billion of student debt cancellation and counting. That's impacted some 4 million Americans. What does that do? It closes the racial wealth gap. It gives people a chance to own their own home because they don't have a mortgage before they have a mortgage.
Yeah.
It increases the likelihood that young entrepreneurial people will start small businesses. This is how government shows up in the lives of ordinary people. And I think that at the end of the day, the question is, who's working for me? Who's thinking about ordinary, hardworking people? And again, Joe Biden has receipts, and we'll continue to make the case.
After the State of the Union, you compared Joe Biden to the boxer Joe Louis. Is that because he was feisty or because you also hope he beats the ever-loving shit out of a Nazi?
Listen, he came out fighting.
Yeah,
I said that night, he came out fighting and he never let up. And I think he'll continue to do that through November. You know, I chastise you for your language, except that when the Affordable Care Act passed, Joe Biden famously said that it was a big deal.
A big deal of some kind.
I won't say it the way he said it.
I thought you were going to chastise me for calling Max Schlemming a Nazi when he was simply a German who was forced to be a part of Nazi propaganda. But we don't have to get into the history. We don't have to get into the history. I said I wouldn't get it. All right. You brought up Joe Louis. I didn't bring it up.
I think I said that night what my point was.
Okay.
The man came out fighting. He never let up.
Two of the biggest black congregations in your state are working together to get out the vote. You are pastor at Ebenezer Baptist Church, as we discussed. What do you think the role of the faith community can be? What should it be in this election?
Oh, it's huge. And I think that's the case for all of our elections. I have often said that I believe that democracy is the political enactment of a spiritual idea. I really believe that it is, it is born of this notion that we were created in what theologians call the imago Dei, or the image of God. And if you're not given to that kind of religious language, this idea that we all have value, that we all have worth as human beings, and if I have value, then I ought to have a voice, and democracy enables that by giving me a vote. And so I think the faith community has an important role to play, and in all times, but especially in a moment like this. It's really the soul of our country, the soul of the nation that is at stake. And we are once again at a critical inflection point, a place where two ways meet. We're somewhere between the hopes of January 5th and the peril of January 6th. We're somewhere between a nation that can send an African-American man who grew up in public housing, the first in his family to graduate from college, to the United States Senate alongside a young Jewish man, the son of an immigrant, both inspired by John Lewis, or that nation that says this is only for some of us. And if this diverse American electorate decides who the president is, we're not going to let that happen. We'll shut it down, even to the point of violence. And so I choose the America of January 5th. I'm aware of the reality of January 6th, and I think we can't be in denial about that. And there's a sense in which we are both of those days.
Yeah.
We're both of them. We can't say that January 6th is not who we are. There's a sense in which that's who we've always been, but we've also been January 5th. We're the latest generation of Americans who get to choose which direction we're going to go in. And I hope that the young people who are listening to this podcast and others will lean in.
So you talked about people valuing themselves, whether it's through faith or just simply finding a sense of purpose, sense of meaning. Church attendance is declining. In 2020, Gallup found that for the first time, a majority of the country no longer said they are members of a church, a mosque, or a synagogue. Do you see that in your own church? Do you see declining membership, especially among young people? And how do you explain it if you can't explain it?
My church is actually growing and not declining. And it's generationally diverse. And to my joy, it is increasingly racially diverse. Dr. King used to say that the most segregated hour in America was 11 o'clock Sunday morning. And I've said to my church for years that if we can't figure out a way to defy that in the church where Martin Luther King Jr. preached, I don't know where else we can do it. So we've been very intentional about that. This might come as a little bit of a surprise to you, but I don't know. I'm not as concerned about church attendance, even though I think it's important. I think that something happens when you're part of a faith community. But I think if church leaders become obsessed with putting people in the seats, mm-hmm. that's the wrong way to think about it. And in my view, it's actually the opposite of the gospel. Jesus said that if you seek to save yourself, you'll lose yourself. But if you give yourself over for my sake, if you give yourself over to something larger than you, you'll save yourself in the process. And so I think that there's a way in which this focus on institutionalism is a good way to kill an institution. The church has to give itself over to what Jesus and all of the great faith traditions fought for: justice, mercy, compassion. Otherwise, you find yourself aligned with the powers in such a way that you actually lose your prophetic voice. And so I have spent my time at Ebenezer long before I ran for the Senate fighting for health care because I believed in it. I wasn't running for anything. I was running to get people health care, fighting for criminal justice reform because I think it is a deep moral contradiction that the United States of America is 5% of the world's population. We warehouse nearly 25% of the prison population in the world. The land of the free is the incarceration capital of the world. I think that the church has to give itself over to fighting for creation, fighting for the planet. And I think to the degree that we do that and young people see a genuine commitment to that, they may not join the church, but they'll join the movement. And I think that's what we had long before we had a church anyway. It was actually a movement that became a church. And I invite folks every week on Sunday when I preach and through the work that I do to join the movement.
Yeah. Well, I talked about this with a rabbi actually this weekend, Rabbi Sharon Brous. And she talks,
a friend of mine, yeah.
And she talks about the fact that that one explanation she has is that there are a lot of people who feel like there's like churches and synagogues and temples that do a lot of ritual that feels disconnected. Mm-hmm. And then there's people trying to appeal to people that are extreme, that are more kind of radical, and that pushes young people away too. But that there has to be something in the middle. I don't think anyone is saying, you know, treat church like YouTube and try to get the numbers up, you know, mention Marjorie Taylor Greene a couple times, see if you can get the view count up. But we do lose something when we lose these places where people gather once a week and participate together. And there is a cost to that. And we see that all over.
I agree. There is a, you know, there's an epidemic of loneliness in our country. And connected to that, people are feeling less happy and more depressed. And I think human connection is healing. There is something that happens. And so what I do say to young folks in my church on Sunday morning and in other places, and not just, you know, all kinds of people, I often hear folks say, I'm not religious, I'm spiritual. And I understand what they're getting at, right?
Mm.
And
are they spiritual, though?
Yeah.
Are they spiritual, did they watch a video?
Well, see, I think that spirituality is tested in community.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to stand up, you know, in some silo and say, I'm spiritual. And I think the way to see the depth of your spirituality is to be in community with other folks who are on the spiritual journey. Because, you know, if you really want to see how deep your spirituality is, you need to be with folks who are there and that are going to get on your nerves.
Yeah.
With whom you're going to disagree, whom you're going to find irksome. And that's where spirituality is tested. It's tested in community. And that's part of what church or the synagogue or the temple provides for us. And it's a community of accountability.
Yeah, but that's sort of what's interesting to me about it, too, because, you know, people, it's a joke, right? Oh, we got to get up. We got to go to church on Sunday. Or I don't want to go to temple today. It's boring. I don't want to go to this service. But there's something that happens when you do these rituals, even when you don't want to do them. And part of it is just that we are in a society now where we are constantly stimulated in ways that don't require us to do the work that would normally have had to be done.
The rituals signify that not only are you part of this living community, but a community that was there before you, a
right.
great cloud of witnesses who passed on that this work of truth-telling and justice-making in the world was going on before you showed up, that someone passed that baton on to you. And how that's helpful in this moment is that it encourages you to take the long view. I think that there is a way in which it's easy to become cynical in this moment because we've seen so much hypocrisy in politics, in religious institutions. I think the problems are so enormous that you can easily become hardened and cynical, give in to despair. But participating in these traditions, at least for me, is the recognition that long before I was fighting for healthcare and Medicaid expansion in Georgia, long before I was fighting for voting rights, which for me is at root about humanity, long before I was fighting for an inclusive community, a beloved community that embraces folks red, yellow, brown, black, and white, members of the LGBTQ community, that's intentional about making sure that we celebrate the gifts and diversity that people who are differently abled bring to the table, that there were folks who were having conversations about this and fighting for it long before me. And that helps me to take the long view so that when we have these moments, when there are these contractions like what we saw between 2016 and 2020, these contractions, these steps backwards, I take the long view that says even if we lose or have a setback in this moment, as Dr. King used to say, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. It is what gives me hope to keep bending that arc.
So last week, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer called for Benjamin Netanyahu to be removed from office. He opened the door to conditioning military aid to Israel, at least opened the door to doing that in the future. On Monday, the U.S. abstained from a vote at the U.N. Security Council, which allowed for passage of a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and for the release of hostages. You said Israel has a right to defend itself. You've called for a negotiated ceasefire and spoken out against the unfolding humanitarian catastrophe. Half of Gaza is on the brink of starvation. Aid cannot reach people, including children who need it. Israel is threatening to invade Rafah, where over a million Palestinians have taken refuge. You've called that morally unjustifiable. You signed on to an amendment to require that any country receiving weapons to use them in accordance with U.S. and international law. What will it take for Congress to use what leverage it has by conditioning aid to Israel? And I know the politics are complex, but how does it make sense morally that we make demands with our statements, that we beseech with our words, but we don't make demands with the resources we provide?
Well, I think with the letter that you saw that I and several others signed on to, You see us doing just that, exploring all the ways in which we use the tools we have to get our ally to do what is necessary to honor the humanity of Palestinian children and to recognize that Palestinian children are every bit as precious as Israeli children. And so that's the work that I've been trying to do as a moral leader, that somehow we've got to center humanity in this. You got me on this faith part of the conversation, which always informs the work that I do. But there, since we're on this path, there's the scripture where Isaiah says that the lion shall lie down next to the lamb and a little child shall lead them. I must say to you that that's always felt and sounded a little idyllic to me. Like, what does that mean? And I, as I've been looking at the situation in Gaza, I've thought about the fact that adversaries and people who are on different sides of a conflict, here's the thing they have in common. They all love their children. And if somehow we can look into the eyes of other people's children and see our own, if we actually believed that the ability of other people's children to thrive is inextricably connected to the future of our own, what set of choices would we make? I think that's what the prophet meant when he said that a little child shall lead them. And so we've seen just devastation that is unspeakable. In recent months with October 7th, we can't turn our eyes away from what happened and the death that happened, the sheer human cruelty, sexual violence used as a weapon of war, elderly people, little babies and children taken, the kind of gratuitous violence and brutality of it all. We can't turn away from that, but we also cannot turn away from the devastation that we've seen in the wake of that. There's an acronym they use in Gaza that basically says wounded child with no surviving family. I can't think of a worse place to be in the world, a worse hand to be dealt coming into the world than to be a wounded child with no surviving family. And so I'm doing the things that I can, and I'm actively looking for ways in which we can continue to use all the tools that we have to get us on a path that leads to peace. Here's what I know. Increasing death and devastation will not end death and devastation. And so we've got to get on another road. And I hope that somehow people on both sides of that conflict, that all of us can tap into the best of our faith and moral traditions as we think about the meaning of Ramadan and Passover, Easter on the horizon for those of us who are Christian, that we can tap into these traditions, center the children, and find our way to a two-state solution that honors the humanity of Palestinian children and Israeli children.
You're talking about empathy and the need to show empathy. And one thing I actually talked about this with Rabbi Bross as well is that people who do not feel safe are not in a position to show as much empathy. That empathy is something that is easier to display when you are safe. It is all well and good to say, oh, we hope that these two sides show empathy to one another. But right now, Israel's planning this invasion of Rafah.
Yep.
And afterwards, there may be time for peace. But right now, we believe it is not only a moral horror, but not in Israel's long-term interest to pursue that path, that it pushes peace, it pushes a two-state solution, it pushes resolution, it pushes safety further away. How do we use our leverage right now to prevent that from happening so that we're not talking about the importance of empathy after we have even more death, after another 10, 20, 30,000 people, innocent people have died?
There's no question that there's a moral urgency to all of this, which is why when I gave the floor speech on the floor of the United States Senate calling for a ceasefire, I said in no uncertain terms that I think it's a mistake, that it would be a grave moral error for Netanyahu to escalate this conflict and to go into Rafah. Palestinian people, in a sense, did what they were told to do. And you got 1.5 million Palestinians sheltering in Rafah. Now to bomb the very area where they were told to go is unimaginable to me. And the relief agencies that are on the ground are saying this. These are folks who don't have a political bone in this fight. They're predicting that this could mean that we'd lose some 85,000 Palestinians on top of the 30,000 that have already been killed. We're talking not only about empathy, but enlightened self-interest. It would be devastating for the people of Gaza. And yes, it would push us further away from peace. I know there are those who say, well, what are we going to do about Hamas, which is a terrorist organization bent on the destruction of Israel? I take that seriously. But if the legacy of the attack on October 7th becomes continuing escalating violence in turn, then Hamas will have already won. Hamas is not just an organization. In fact, I think the ideology is much more dangerous, much more lethal, especially now, than the organization. It is an ideology that lies in a place deeper than any of the tunnels beneath Gaza. And somehow we've got to disrupt that mindset. And I still remain hopeful that we will use all the diplomatic tools that we have, that we will use the pressure that we have. Israel is a sovereign state. We respect its sovereignty. But as you point out, as we provide the resources for Israel, we have a right, and I think a moral obligation, to ensure that what happens with the resources, with the weapons, is consistent with American values, and that we have an ability to speak with moral authority and credibility in the world. That's important for the long-term national security of our country and for the prospects of peace, not only in this conflict, but in conflicts in the future.
Switching gears, one thing I wanted to ask you about, there's this bill to ban TikTok, well, to force TikTok to be sold. It passed the House. It does seem as though there's these behind closed doors briefings about how terrifying the invasion of privacy is by this Chinese owned company. And that's why the House passed this bill to force a sale or the app would be banned. We as the American, the free American people using apps on our phone that we as we choose don't have the classified briefing. Have you been in these briefings? Where are you on TikTok? Do you want ByteDance to sell it? Do you want to support something that forces them to sell it?
You know, I thought you would be kind to me. This is the most controversial thing you've asked me about all day.
Is that
we got to talk about TikTok, really?
Yeah. My thing about it is that just if it's really dangerous, tell us.
Listen, so
you don't want to get flamed on TikTok. You don't want to get ripped to pieces. You're a man of God, and you're afraid of these teens.
Exactly. I
you're a teen fearing man.
For the first time, I am hearing from the 13-year-old constituents in Georgia.
All right. Well, they can't vote.
And they're reminding me that the next time I'm up, they will be.
Oh, that's true. Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. Well, here, have you been in these closed-door classified briefings? If the American people got to see what members of Congress had seen, would they be more alarmed? Would they be would they throw their phones away? What would happen?
I have, and what I have seen is concerning. It gives me pause. And there's a way in which we have been getting this information now over the last few years. And so I do think it's important for Congress to act, but I also think it's important for us to act in a thoughtful way. And so this is not a politician's answer. My 13-year-old constituents and my 7-year-old daughter at home notwithstanding, I do think that we need to act in a thoughtful way. So, you know, I'm looking at the various proposals. There's more than one way to think about how to respond to this. But there's a way in which, as you point out, it's that classic balance between national security, on the other hand, mm-hmm. and the values that we have around freedom and expression and all of that on the other hand. And both of those things have to be protected. So we'll see where we land.
All right, last question. You show up to church, and there, sitting in the front row, hands folded in his lap, Donald Trump. You have your sermon. Are you just giving your sermon as prepared? Are you throwing it out? Are you talking to him directly? What do you think he would say? You don't know why he's there. You don't know if he's had some big change of heart or something.
We're Ebenezer Baptist Church and the Church of Dr. King, and we're a church. So any and everybody's welcome to the church. And I think that in my case, I wouldn't have to change the sermon. Because if you heard me on Sunday morning and the things that I tend to talk about, I'm sure there'll be plenty for him and others to consider.
Senator Reverend Raphael Warnock, a God-fearing, a teen-fearing man. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Great to be here with you.
All right. Thanks to Senator Warnock for joining us. And we'll have another episode for you guys on Wednesday. Take care. If you want to get ad-free episodes, exclusive content, and more, consider joining our Friends of the Pod subscription community at crooked.com/friends. And if you're already doomscrolling, don't forget to follow us at Pod Save America on Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube for access to full episodes, bonus content, and more. Plus, if you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping us a review. Pod Save America is a Crooked Media production. Our show is produced by Olivia Martinez and David Toledo. Our associate producers are Saul Rubin and Farah Safari. Kira Joaquim is our senior producer. Reed Cherlin is our executive producer. The show is mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick. Jordan Cantor is our sound engineer, with audio support from Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Writing support by Hallie Kiefer. Madeline Herringer is our head of news and programming. Matt DeGroat is our head of production. Andy Taft is our executive assistant. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, Haley Jones, Mia Kelman, David Tolles, Kirill Pelaviv, and Molly Lobel.
If you guys like Pod Save America, please consider subscribing to our Friends of the Pod program. So Friends of the Pod get lots of stuff. You get more Pod Save America. That includes our new show, which is called Pod Save America Only Friends.
It's where Dan gets naked.
Where Dan gets full frontal nudity, but mostly it's a bi-weekly subscription exclusive podcast that is basically Pod Save America, but behind a paywall. So it's a little bit looser and more fun. And it's Lovett and Favreau and me and Pfeiffer and then other Crooked hosts. We go deeper on the news and cover more stories. You also get Open Tabs, which is a weekly behind-the-scenes newsletter from the show. Plus, you get ad-free episodes of your favorite Crooked podcasts and all kinds of other stuff. Dan will come to your house and clean it once every quarter.
Yeah, clothed.
Dan is very busy, clothed only. But along with just getting great content, becoming a friend of the pod, joining our subscription community, is the number one thing you can do to help us grow, to help independent progressive media. So if you've ever thought about doing it, if you ever wanted more Pod Save America, consider going to crooked.com/friends and becoming a friend of the pod.